Court will now proceed to the third case, United States v. Borostowski. Mr. Hillis.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Daniel Hillis. I'm with the Federal Public Defender's Office, and I represent Michael Borostowski. Mr. Borostowski raises three issues on appeal. The district court first erred when it found that Mr. Borostowski was not in custody when agents questioned him. Under the facts of this case, a reasonable person would not have felt at liberty to end the interrogation that the agents had begun. Factors set forth in O'Connor v. Flores, which is precedent from this circuit, established that Mr. Borostowski was in custody. In that case, applied a seven-factor test. None of the factors are dispositive. However, on balance, I believe that the factors, if not all, close to six of the seven, would support a finding that my client was in custody for purposes of the interrogation. And I'll go through those briefly, as they are important, but not to engage in a parade of horribles. The encounter took place
thank you.
In my client's family home. It was not in a public place. Mr. Borostowski was pressured by agents to speak to them. It wasn't as if he went there voluntarily to talk to them. The agents told him that he was free to leave, but their actions showed that that wasn't
so. Who were they arresting? What were these FBI agents?
It was a joint task force. It was predominated by FBI agents, but they pretty much had everybody who was on law enforcement in some capacity there. And it wasn't just 13 agents. Yes, and it wasn't just 13 agents that secured the home and were
going. So it was a variety of agents, not just from one agency.
Yes, the streets were, it's a dead-end street, a cul-de-sac, I believe, of some sort, and it was cordoned off, and there was really a huge presence of law enforcement.
Would you refresh my memory, please? The two either agents or FBI or East Peoria police officers, the two who were in the little room with him, the little bedroom, were they East Peoria police officers or were they actual FBI agents?
Both were FBI agents.
You're they were both. Okay, yeah.
To Agent Nixon and to Agent Spencer.
Yeah.
And with respect to those two agents, the agents restrained my client with handcuffs, and I don't know which agent placed the cuffs on him, but it was Agent Nixon that guarded my client persistently, moved him about. He was, of course, lightly attired at best. He was barefoot. He was in handcuffs.
How soon were the cuffs put on him?
I believe that was immediate. When they showed up at the house around 6 a.m., shortly after 6 a.m., they brought him out, and I believe he was handcuffed immediately as a matter of security protocol.
And he was in warm-ups or something like that.
I believe he was in sweatpants and a short-sleeved shirt, barefooted in the lawn for approximately 25 minutes from what I can gauge by this, moved about, guarded constantly. Even when he was brought inside, brought upstairs to a second-story bedroom that was small, and that's relevant to United States versus Slate, and it was, I believe, tightly packed with, perhaps not packed, but tightly situated with respect to furniture. The two agents were present. My client's cuffs were then taken off, but he's in the second-story bedroom, which, of course, is a deliberate choice by the agents where to take him. It makes it, of course, less likely that he is able to leave when the door gets closed, but also he's in a second-story room which is small. I believe that's of some importance here as well. And when he needs to finally leave, he leaves for nothing. He's a person who's there under questioning for upwards of 2 hours. Persistent questioning on a serious matter, talks about having a lawyer there. They engage him and, I believe, dissuade him from having a lawyer, though he specifically notes that he had a federal public defender there before on his previous case. Mentions his name. He is dissuaded in some fashion.
He asks twice. Is that correct? Twice.
He does, Your Honor. And because the district court found that there was no custody, it does not engage in an examination of the invocation. But that hopefully will be a matter for another day if there's remand. And I believe that he did adequately invoke. But again, that's not a matter on this appeal. But when he needs to do finally, the most basic thing, use a bathroom. He's not even free to go use his own bathroom in his own house by himself. He is under guard. He is escorted to the bathroom. When he is done using the bathroom and agents are outside in the hallway, he is escorted back into the room yet again. There's a threatening presence of the agents, and although the government mentioned in its brief they didn't have tactical rifles, that's fine, but they had deadly firepower. They were all armed. I think agents carry guns like I wear pants. It's every day when they leave the house. So these people, if they didn't display weapons,
well,
they never
that's a relief.
And the presence of tactical weapons is not, tactical rifles is not a dispositive factor. They are armed. They are multiple. They are present. They, of course,
I mean that you wear pants, not the
yes, Your Honor. And also, insofar as the government's agents didn't yell and they didn't threaten, beat their chest, that's all fine. But they are there in a commanding presence, and they spoke to him as if they were in control. And so I don't think raising your voice is really an essential thing in this case. And while it didn't happen, the more important thing is, did they speak to him in a commanding fashion, dictating to him where to go, what to do, and how to do it? I believe that's all present here. So these factors, as I've laid them out, are very much on a par with Sprosty versus Buckler, which is a case that we've cited in our brief, and a case which established that there was custody and resulted in...
Excuse me, can I just go back a second, because this is, relates to a question Judge Rovner asked. Didn't they ask him if he knew the name of his federal defender, or the defender?
Yes.
And he didn't recall what the name was.
He mentioned it by name, Your Honor. Robert
we
Alvarado.
Did
he did. The agents didn't want an attorney there. They wanted to have the flow of information go on unimpeded. And that's what they got. And that's the concern that we have here. Moving on to the second issue. The first search warrant didn't authorize, unless I beg your pardon, the court has questions on that. The first search warrant didn't authorize a search of the Chevy Blazer. Now, the agents had, up to this point, prior to the execution of the search warrant, engaged in surveillance and collected intel about who lived there, what cars there were, who owned them, and so forth. In United States versus Evans, this court explained that while a vehicle could be searched pursuant to a search warrant if the vehicle has a possible connection to illegal activity, there was no illegal activity that the agent suspected, apparently, as to the Blazer. It wasn't included in the warrant. Had she suspected it, she would have likely included it, or I would say should have included it. Evans prohibits police from searching containers that obviously belong to someone wholly uninvolved in criminal activities going on in the house. The vehicle is essentially a container, and the government makes that argument. The important thing, though, is the vehicle connected to criminal activity? There was nothing articulated in the search warrant. There was nothing that allowed the Chevy Blazer to be searched, therefore. In this case, the Chevy Blazer was searched anyway. It belonged to Dolly Borostowski. She was wholly uninvolved in any criminal activity. She is my client's mother. So the first search warrant doesn't authorize agents to search the Chevy Blazer because it's unconnected to any criminal activity. The fact that the agents didn't include the Blazer in the search warrant, I think, is a telling fact. They didn't have articulable suspicion about the vehicle, and therefore they didn't list it, and it shouldn't have been searched.
Did the mother indicate the use by the defendant?
The mother spoke to the case agent and did indicate that the vehicle was used, but it's only then, and that's after the warrant had been issued. I believe the agent may have known if the vehicle was used by Mr. Borostowski. I'm not certain on that fact.
Didn't she confirm that the defendant frequently used her car? She did. And why would that not be enough to demonstrate that the car comes within the purview of Griffin and Percival and Evans and...
The fact that he's using the vehicle does not connect it to any criminal activity.
But she had voluntarily gone out to the car. Well, all right. If his mother had voluntarily gone out to that car and brought the hard drive into the house, would the first warrant have allowed the agent to seize it and search it at that point?
I believe that under United States versus Basinski, that would be a problem because the agents would likely have known that from their discussion with her that was not her hard drive. It was Mr. Borostowski's. She would not have actual or apparent authority to turn the hard drive over for a search. That leads, Your Honor, to the concern, I think, about the consent form that Mrs. Borostowski signed. She signed a consent
form. So if she had gone out, brought the hard drive in, are you saying, and handed it to them, are you saying if they said to her, is this your hard drive? And she would say no, she'd have to hand it back? I mean, they'd have to hand it back?
I believe that the prudent thing to have done at that point would be to find out whose it was, I believe that they knew, and to get a second search warrant. There's nothing exigent that would have prevented the agents from getting a search warrant at that point for the hard drive. They knew that it wasn't Mrs. Borostowski's. They couldn't use her as an end run around any sort of warrant requirement to get materials that they couldn't otherwise search. So the consent allows them to search the vehicle, or seize the material from it, but not to look in the hard drive once it's recovered. I believe that the agents knew that, and that's why they went and got a second warrant. But there's a problem with the second warrant. The second warrant is containing information in the affidavit, the request. The agents had previewed the hard drive and made that fact known. They did it as a matter of disclosure, but it's a problem because it then puts in the mind, it plants the idea that there already is child pornography on this hard drive. It's included in the affidavit, but in any event, under Markling and Murray, the district court at that point is required under the independent source doctrine to make a two-part analysis to make explicit findings. That didn't happen here either, so that's a problem as well. Unless the court has questions on that topic.
Did the original search warrant for the house make reference to the, did the niece live there?
The niece lived there, and she, as I understand it, had a car as well because she transported herself to work. I beg your pardon. Mr. Borostowski's sister lives there. The niece, I do not understand, lives there in the residence.
Did not live there?
I don't understand that to be the case, Your Honor. But I will conclude with this on the topic of the search of the Chevy Blazer. This court in Griffin, which Your Honor mentioned, and in Percival, and in the Lefebvre treatise that is cited, says the better practice, the preferred practice, is list the vehicles by name, identify them, rather describe them, so that there's no doubt about what happens here. Those cases are 20 years old, and despite that rather pointed direction from this court, the government still is not listing the vehicles. I believe that it should, and so we'd ask that if this case is remanded, that there be a specific instruction that warrants should henceforth include a description of the vehicle if the agents wish to search them. I'll briefly comment on my third argument and then save the balance of my time for rebuttal, but that third argument is along the lines of what this court has already determined as a matter of precedent, Corona-Gonzalez, Durham, and Halliday. If my client legitimately said anything about pimping and prostituting his niece, that would be appropriate to rely on as a sentencing issue, but there was no information about that in the record. It was a materially incorrect statement based on misinformation. It affects his Fifth Amendment rights and affects the nature of the sentence chosen. We believe that for all these reasons, this court should reverse. I'll reserve the balance of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Ellis. Mr. Robinson?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court and Mr. Hillis. My name is Greg Walters. I'm an assistant United States attorney.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Walter. I apologize.
That's fine, Judge Fong.
That's the next guy, the next case. Sorry.
I represent the government in this case. I want to primarily concentrate on what I think are the two more challenging issues, that being the custody issue. And then secondly, looking at the scope of the search warrant, and then if time permits, to follow up with independent source.
I would really like you to zero in on whether he was in custody, because by your own description of the scene, you know, there are these 13 armed agents roaming the house. He's led out into from one place to another. He's, you know, in handcuffs for a significant period of time. Two armed agents in a small room who interrogate him for 2.5 hours. One standing between him and the door. He felt the need to ask if he could use the bathroom in his own home, accompanied by an agent. Your own agent say he would be free to go if the case agent permitted it.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last part, Your Honor, the free to go and the next agent.
If the case agent permitted it.
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah. That's a footnote in the blue brief, I think. He asks for a lawyer twice. He actually mentions the name of his previous lawyer. It's just not, I don't think it's at all clear whether he's actually free to go, much less whether any reasonable person would have believed he was free to go. So give me your best case law supporting a finding that he really was not in custody under these facts.
I would be happy to, Your Honor. May I first start with saying I share your concerns as a government attorney when I first saw about the 13 agents. I don't think there's a way to blunt that, of having 13 agents present for a search.
And thank you for not trying to.
As far as citing to you the best case law, first, if
can I just back up in the 13 agents? I'm again curious about the makeup of this joint task force.
Sure.
We had two FBI agents that did the interrogation, apparently.
Is that correct, Your Honor?
What was the makeup of the rest of the...
The rest of the makeup, there were, of the 13 officers, 12 were law enforcement, one was a forensic examiner. I'm not making a big deal about that. He wouldn't have been armed.
Peoria police officers?
No, Your Honor. Forensic examiner William O'Sullivan.
No, I meant the other officers.
There were two East Peoria detectives that are assigned to the Peoria resident agency. That would have been Special Agent Amanda Hoffman, Special Federal Officer Amanda Hoffman, which was the lead officer on the scene.
They were assigned to the...
There's a task force officer, David Catone, I believe, with the Illinois State Police, and there was one other detective with East Peoria that has dual credentials as well.
So there were three local police officers, but they were assigned to the...
They were credentialed FBI task force officers, and there were going to be, then the other remaining 10 were, 11 were special, 9 were special agents, 1 was a forensics examiner. And then, as Mr. Hillis pointed out, there was some local traffic control, which was
mostly
done.
FBI plus the temporary FBI. Was referred to.
Correct, Your Honor. A total of 10 actual FBI employees, 3 task force officers. Judge Rovner, coming back to your question, if I could first correct something, I think, in the record. I know Jason Nixon testified that in response on cross-examination, well, he wasn't free to leave. He was talking, but later in the transcript, he talks about the default position wasn't that he wasn't free to leave. He wasn't just free to go through the search scene unescorted. I don't want to make semantics. Mm-hmm. I'm not asking the court to make a semantical difference, but what I don't want the court to think is he was speaking out of both sides of his mouth, that because it was a secure scene, which is common for a search warrant scene, and that's why the custodial interrogation is a two-part test. It's not just whether they feel the complete freedom, because once there's restriction of movement, which is present in this case, then we start looking at the other factors to determine whether it was custodial interrogation. And that's from House v. Fields, which this court has recently cited in the Pelletier case. So we're looking at first, was a restraint of freedom or restraint of movement, was it curtailed, the freedom of movement? And yes, that's present in this case. And then we look at the second part, and that's the presence of the same inherently coercive pressures that were present during the station house questioning in Miranda. And so the factors that weigh against us, and I believe we've acknowledged those in our brief, certainly the strong presence of law enforcement, handcuffed at the beginning when he was brought out of the house. He was the one individual who was subject to a search warrant. I won't pretend to tell you that the search on the individual himself would have taken 20 minutes. He was then escorted upstairs, still in handcuffs, and then the cuffs came off. I do believe it's important factor-wise. Mr. Hillis points out that, well, the conversational tone shouldn't shouldn't be a factor or a strong factor. I do believe it is a factor for this court to weigh. The way he was spoken to, he's told he's not under arrest. Now, again, can the circumstances show differently than that? Absolutely. But then we start looking at, he was given Miranda warnings. He was told you don't have to answer questions. And what I'd like to point out is, in fact, when it came time for him, when they asked if he was going to complete the statement, he said no. I'm not going to complete the written statement. In fact, I'm not going to hand it over to you. And so if he is facing the inherently coercive pressures of interrogation that were similar to those of Miranda, he felt the freedom still, after more than 2 hours of questioning, to say, I'm not going to hand this over to you, and I'm not going to complete it. And he wasn't badgered to do so. Now, Mr. Hillis points out, well, they came back and did retrieve that statement later, but that doesn't address the point that he felt the freedom at that time during interrogation to basically say no to these agents. And not
Mr. Walters, how soon does the, what is the time gap between the I'm not going to sign it and I do sign it, when they come back at him?
Well, what happened, Your Honor, I think that if we look at the testimony, at approximately 8 a.m. in the morning, now, say the interview started right around 6:30, the Miranda form, 6:35, the Miranda form signed about 10 minutes later. So we're about an hour and a half into the interview when they provide him with the written statement for him to fill out, not for the agents, somewhere in there. And for about the next half hour, as they're talking to him and the interview's winding down, he's filling it out. Special Agent Spencer leaves the room at 8:30 to go down and talk to Special Agent or Amanda Hoffman about the hard drive. And then you have Agent Spencer come back up, and towards the end of the interview, they asked him, would you provide it? So it was about an hour and a half into it, towards the end of the interview, which is wrapping up around 9 o'clock. They reach for it or ask for it. He says, I don't want to complete it, and then does not give them the statement.
Did I understand at some point, or maybe you're getting to it, he asked to go to the bathroom?
I believe he said he had to use the bathroom, yes, Your Honor.
And they permitted it or not?
Yeah, he did go to the bathroom, yes. I think the issue that Mr. Hillis has brought up is that he's escorted to the bathroom and escorted back. Okay. And again, I would say that's consistent with the secure search scene, understanding, just as this court found in Sprosty, that being under guard the entire time is a factor that indicates custody. What I'd like to point out, the distinction is that the guard in Sprosty was a uniformed police officer, that he was assigned for the purpose of guarding that particular interviewee. In this case, it happened to be that Jason Nixon was in line entering the home that Mr. Borstowski was passed to him, but Jason Nixon was really assigned to be the interviewer, so it just worked out that the same person that handcuffed him is the same one that ended up interviewing him. And so the interview takes place during the course of most of the search warrant. So, of course, he's going to be in the interviewee's interviewer's presence as long as he's continuing to interview. Your Honor, I know, Judge Rovner, your question, if I could come back to it, that I don't want to use the term parade of horribles, but you certainly were going through a list of factors. And one of them was, well, he asked for an attorney twice. And if we look at the court's opinion in Sprosty, there were two issues, whether he was in custody and whether he invoked. Because in that case, the interviewee was provided with Miranda warnings, just like in this case. And this court didn't jump right to the invocation issue. In fact, it addressed custody first because it said, absent custody, the procedural right to invoke custody under Edwards or Miranda Edwards doesn't apply. And so, assuming those were invocations, and I understand that not to be an issue on appeal, it's putting the cart before the horse as to whether he was first in custody. And I think, again, we can weigh factors, and I think we've acknowledged that there are factors issues. But I think
we all have a pretty good fix on this custody issue, Mr. Walters.
I think
If we are faced with a remand situation, I'd like you to speak to that.
On the Fourth Amendment issue?
Yes.
I understand that this court has said, as Mr. Hillis pointed out over 20 years ago, that the prudent course, the best course, is to specify the vehicle. We wouldn't be here arguing this issue if that were the case. But with that said, I don't even think the court today has to rule blanketly that if there's a vehicle parked on the premises to be searched, that it may be searched under a search warrant under the unique facts of this case, when Mrs. Borostowski, the owner of that vehicle, the Blazer, has given her consent, the agents standing on that premises pull it out and are holding that hard drive, and yet they have to go get another search warrant. So I don't think the court has to go far in saying that falls directly within the scope of the search warrant. It would be somewhat form over substance to say, well, because you've got that hard drive by consent, that you're standing on the premises, you need to go get a second search warrant, even though that container, that hard drive, is within the scope of the search warrant. And in fact, I'd even think the court could go as far as saying it need not do so. But even under the reasoning of Ross, that the legal search of a fixed, the Supreme Court's decision in Ross, a legal search of a fixed premises extends to any area in which the item to be searched for may be found. And there's not a separate probable cause determination that has to go through container by container by container. And what you have on this driveway in the Blazer is, in fact, a container.
It has the car is on the property, and the search warrant was for the property.
Correct, Your Honor. And I believe in this court's prudent admonition to list vehicles. It didn't happen in this case. But that shouldn't be the reason to then say, well, because you didn't follow what is the best course, that that's necessarily unreasonable under the Fourth Amendment. On that same point, Judge Flom, you said get to the on remand. In Markling, this court addressed this very issue of independent source with tainted information in the affidavit. And it treated it very much exactly like a Franks hearing. You extract out the tainted information, does PC probable cause still exist? It's not a subjective inquiry into the magistrate's mind or Judge Gorman's mind. I think in this case, as a matter of law, the court can find that that affidavit established probable cause. The question is whether the agents would have sought that search warrant absent the allegedly tainted information, that being the pornography on the hard drive, or if the court were to find the confession to be inappropriate. The court cannot make that factual finding. I think the record well supports the district court making the finding, given the fact that the hard drive was the focus almost exclusively of the search, but that remains to be answered another day. So ultimately, Your Honors, we are asking that the court affirm the judgment of the district court, and absent any questions from the court, I will sit down.
Thank you, Mr. Walters.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Hillis?
Your Honors, I'll largely stand on what I put in my brief to address the various comments the government made in its argument. However, I do wish to emphasize something that I think is important. Well, the government mentions Ross. This circuit's decision in Evans clearly states that to search something, there has to be a possible connection to illegal activity. And there was nothing in that Blazer at the time the agents sought the search warrant that led them to include it because of any possible connection to illegal activity. If they became aware of it later, there is a telephone, there's something they could easily do to contact a judge to get a warrant issued to search then. We shouldn't allow this blanket effort to allow officers to show up and search any vehicle that they find in a given area just because there is a warrant out there that uses the term of art premises. That will establish a dangerous precedent, and that is inconsistent with evidence.
How limited would you say, Mr. Hillis, it is? Would you limit any area of the house?
No. I would not, Your Honor.
A garage?
No, I would not. The garage is fairly part of the premises.
Yeah. Unless the agents, home?
Unless the agents knew that the mobile home, say it's on another tract of land, belonged to somebody else, wholly unconnected to an offense, then yes. And if they have cause to believe later through the interview process that that could be connected, again, there's an easy mechanism. We should not do what is on page 27 of the government's brief, and that is to allow this sort of thing where the government says, undoubtedly there exists the risk that an automobile parked on a premises driveway is that an innocent guest or occupant. We shouldn't throw those sort of property interests under the bus of the government's investigative efforts. We ask for a limitation.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Hillis. Thank you, Mr.
Walters.
Case is taken under advisement. The court will proceed.